Welcome to Ankh Live On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. Ankh Live On Air is a podcast from Ankh Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Ankh Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Ankh Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Salt Lake City, Utah, for the State of the Science Summit on Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. At the meeting, faculty from the University of Utah and Intermountain Healthcare delved into biomarker discoveries, research regarding the heredity of lung cancer, emerging treatment modalities, and practice-changing trials that have impacted the paradigm. Other topics included the role of immunotherapy and combinations that are generating excitement in this space, as well as novel drugs that are revolutionizing the treatment of patients with non-small cell lung cancer whose tumors harbor ROS1 and ALK mutations. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Wallace L. Ackerley, MD, a professor of internal medicine and director of the Lung Cancer Disease Center of Excellence at Huntsman Cancer Institute of the University of Utah. Ackerley told us that patients should undergo broad molecular profiling in order to determine whether they stand to benefit from the increasing array of targeted therapies that are showing remarkable responses. The emergence of these biomarkers has completely changed the way patients with lung cancer are treated, said Ackerley. In our interview, Ackerley shed light on targeted approaches available for patients with non-small cell lung cancer who harbor MET, RET, or HER2 alterations.
There's a number of new biomarkers in lung cancer, and every time you come up with a new drug, you would love to find the biomarker that makes the most important. MET is a very important marker at this point. Unique in the sense that it turns out it can be both a resistance marker as well as a primary marker or driver of lung cancer. It's the mutation that can make a cancer. So MET mutated exon 14 skipping mutations are not that common, but common enough. And we've been working in a phase 2 study with capmatinib. In fact, we were just one of the authors at the World Lung Conference just this month, and enrolled a number of patients on this study, and it's been a remarkable drug. This kinase inhibitor causes a response in the majority of patients. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. It is easy to take. Tolerance is really very good. And it's one of those Lazarus kind of kinases that the patients can be very sick in the beginning, but treatment with these agents can bring them back from the dead, that response rates are high and their performance status improves with the drug. Of all of the kinase inhibitors that I have used for lung cancer, LOXO-292 or selpercatinib, I think is the new name, is the most exciting of any of the drugs that I've worked with. It has a response rate in the 80% range and has a very large fraction of patients who have stable disease. So again, disease control rate is very, very high. The part that's unique is the drug is highly specific. Many drugs are somewhat dirty kinases, meaning they hit a lot of kinases, but this one is almost specific just for the RET mutation. Consequently, we're able to give extremely high doses with almost no side effects because there's really very little off target. And so most of the target is the cancer. And of all of the drugs that I've used in the last 30 years, this one is perhaps the best tolerated with almost no side effects whatsoever. And the improvement in patients' stage or status has been remarkable. Patients have gone from being bedridden to being strong enough to be able to return to work. Overwhelming. So the quality of the response, the fact that it does cross blood-brain barrier, and the duration of the response has been overwhelming. So the lung cancer world has changed dramatically. The majority of patients don't have a biomarker, and of the biomarkers, everyone's totally aware of EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF. Those are the gold standards, but there's a number of rare mutations that do show up and have activity. We've been using adotrastuzumab for patients with HER2 mutations, but there's a number of other oral agents that can be used only in clinical trials. But we've been able to use the adotrastuzumab that's been approved for breast cancer, and we can use it off study. It's important because it does work. It is a chemotherapy. We understand it very well. But it does work, but only if you actually look for the HER2 mutation. So the important piece here is that people can do single mutation or PCRs, and that's great, but NCCN and most lung cancer physicians would recommend a broad panel. If you don't look for the many possibilities or many opportunities for treatment, you're just going to miss them. And HER2 is one that's not very common, probably in the 2% range, but for those 2% of patients, you can get a very strong response, even though there is no FDA-approved drug for HER2-mutated lung cancer.
Afterward, William T. Sauce, MD, stopped by to explain how the treatment for patients with stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer has evolved over the past few decades to include modalities such as chemoradiation and immunotherapy. According to Sauce, who is a radiation oncologist at Intermountain Healthcare, one of the biggest improvements that have been made is in patient selection. Another key area of advancement has been the introduction of immunotherapy into the paradigm, he added. In our interview, Sauce provided a historical perspective on the optimal management of patients with stage 3 disease.
So earlier in our experience, in fact, many of the trials that we conducted during the 80s were negative trials. They really showed no benefit to combining chemotherapy and radiation. But as we moved into the 90s, we began to select patients more appropriately for the treatment. Patients that could tolerate the chemotherapy well, patients that did not have advanced anatomic disease. And when we were able to select those patients, their for performance and for physiology, they did dramatically better. And in that group of patients, there was a definite benefit to incorporating chemotherapy with radiation. Well, several factors. One, the anatomic stage of the disease. Even though they may have palpable supraclavicular nodes, many of those patients were excluded from our combined trials, even though they were advanced stage 3 patients. Patients with poor pulmonary function or advanced mediastinal disease that made radiation difficult, or patients with poor performance, greater than 10% weight loss, those patients did not tolerate systemic therapy very well. So when we eliminated those patients from the protocols, we were able to see a benefit. Backbone of combined therapy has been the use of cisplatin. And the incorporation of cisplatin with concurrent radiation has been a dramatic improvement. Even though the backbone is cisplatin, when we look at other doublets of chemotherapy, gemcitabine, taxanes, there's probably no dramatic difference between the different regimes, at least in stage 4 disease. In stage 3 disease, when we're using the drugs as a radiosensitizer, then there's probably a definite benefit to using cisplatin. Cisplatin is not an easy drug to tolerate, particularly in the elderly, and we're always looking ways to make it better tolerated and find alternatives to cisplatin. Immunotherapy has made a dramatic improvement in our treatment of the majority of lung cancer. The molecular targeted agents have also been exceptionally beneficial, but the reality is that only a small number of patients are candidates for the molecular targeted agent, whereas almost everybody is a candidate for immunotherapy. So it's made a dramatic change in how we treat lung cancer.
Next, Trudy G. Oliver, BSc, PhD, stopped by to discuss her research with mouse models in lung cancer. When she sat down with us, she expanded on the rationale for using mouse models in this disease, some of the work being done with these models, and how this work is contributing to a better understanding of lung cancer subtypes, as well as the novel agents that have been identified via this research.
The mouse lung is highly similar to the human lung in many ways. Mice are also 92% genetically identical to humans, so it's not surprising that when we alter the right genes in the mouse, it does exactly what happens in the human in terms of lung cancer subtypes, what the tumors look like, their gene expression, and how they progress and mimic the progression that you see in humans, including metastases and drug resistance. But on top of all those similarities, they have advantages for doing studies in that they're very rapid and we have big litters, and so we have lots of controlled genetic patients to do our studies in. And we can basically mimic the clinical trials that happen in people, but in a more controlled setting. Because mice are a genetic tool, you can ultimately tease out the mechanisms of why things work. And of course, the better we understand mechanisms, the better we can, do better the next time as we understand what works and doesn't work. There's a broad lung cancer research community in mouse models, so there are many, many investigators out there. I think we've, at this point, done a pretty good job modeling the major subtypes of lung cancer. So we have pretty great models for small cell and squamous lung cancer and adenocarcinoma, and those are based on the genes that are altered in the human disease. Now with sort of the emergence of immunotherapy, I think there's become a renewed interest in the fact that they are an immune competent tool. We have very few in vivo immune competent tools that we can understand the immune system, and I think that's a pretty urgent need and a new utility that's really kind of exploding in the mouse model world. And of course, with the advent of CRISPR, we have so many more genetic tools at our disposal, so we can make deletions and insertions and point mutations and now even translocations, and so we've gotten really sophisticated at mimicking what happens in human tumors in the mouse. I'll highlight today one that we're pursuing in our lab in small cell lung cancer. So as I said, the one example I'm going to give is how we found that small cell is comprised of distinct molecular subtypes. One target that we found was Aurora kinase inhibition, which consistently in human cell lines and in mouse models and now in clinical trials, we find that a specific subgroup of patients that are high for the protein c-MYC tend to be the better responders. Given that the mouse did a good job in sort of reflecting what happened in clinical trials, we are now looking for other targets that work better. And one of those that we found in our cell line and mouse and PDX studies is an agent that deprives tumors of arginine. So it is simply an enzyme that degrades extracellular arginine and is basically hitting a key metabolic vulnerability of the tumors. So we have now enough preclinical data to warrant pursuing that in clinical trials, and that's sort of where we are trying to initiate trials at the Huntsman Cancer Institute. And you know, if the mouse is a good model still as it's been before for this particular subtype, then you know, I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to see a difference in patients as well.
After delivering an intriguing presentation on the heredity of lung cancer, Lisa A. Cannon Albright, PhD, an adjunct professor of family and preventative medicine and a professor of internal medicine at the University of Utah School of Medicine, joined us to discuss the topic further. She told us that by tracing Utah's genealogy back to its founders, her team has been able to identify the subset of family pedigrees with the greatest predisposition to lung cancer, thus arming investigators with the potential to uncover genetic components of the disease and inform prophylactic measures. According to Cannon Albright, who is also chief of genetic epidemiology at the University of Utah, family history is key to understanding heredity in lung cancer. Specifically, the presence of a positive family history for lung cancer is indicative of increased risk for the disease. In our interview, Cannon Albright shared some of her research and shed light on histologic subgroups at increased risk of lung cancer.
I did this with my collaborator, Wally Akerley, who's the lung cancer specialist. So the first thing we thought about was histologic subgroups. And I guess there's a lot of kind of rare subgroups. But really, what we did was split it into small cell lung cancers and non-small cell lung cancers, which are more common. And then the non-small cell lung cancers we split into squamous and non-squamous histology. So those are the histologic subgroups we looked at. And then, of course, if you look at people who have lung cancer, by and large, the majority are smokers. It's a huge risk factor. But you do identify individuals who have lung cancer who never smoked. Again, this incredible resource in Utah has a very unique feature. Utah, in the 1980s, was, I believe, the first state to add a question about tobacco use to the death certificate. And the death certificates in Utah are also linked to this genealogy of the state. So I can go in and find, for probably about half lung cancer cases, I can find their death certificate and determine whether whether the clinician felt that tobacco contributed to the cause of death. So we also look at smokers versus non-smokers in terms of evidence for a genetic contribution. And basically you see that both of those cluster in families, and that makes a lot of sense. And so what we did then was split the smokers and non-smokers into the histologic subgroups. And small cell lung cancer basically looks like any familial effects you see are probably largely caused by the familiality of smoking in close relatives. But for non-small cell, non-squamous lung cancers in non-smokers, there's just a clear signal of a genetic contribution. And as part of this analysis, we actually can identify specific high-risk pedigrees, and those will be the pedigrees we study. People have noticed and studied lung cancer in families for a long time, but lung cancer is different than a lot of cancers because the common environment, common risk factors are confounded. So we've all noticed that smoking can cluster in relatives, in families, and so if lung cancer is clustering in a family where there are smokers, there's a serious confounding. It makes it really hard to ask the statistical questions that we need to ask. So, and then another major risk factor is radon exposure. And again, people who are related to each other, the more closely related they are, the more of their lifetime they've spent in the same environment. So those are probably the big risk factors that we think about in combination with family history. And Utah is interesting because it actually has the lowest tobacco use rate in the United States because of the strong Mormon culture here that has prescriptions against use of tobacco. Nevertheless, most people with lung cancer still have the tobacco exposure. So we also have high radon here in Utah. So two of those major risk factors are here in Utah and confounded with families. So to me, the opportunity that's so awesome in Utah is that you can, I like to say, you know, cut away the noise and just look at the signal. So if I can study a family that has statistically more lung cancer than I would have expected given the age and sex of the individuals, and I can identify non-smokers, then I get rid of a little bit of that environmental noise and confounding, and I have a better chance of finding the signal for the gene or genes that are responsible.
Overall survival data from the Phase 3 FLORA trial presented at the 2019 ESMO Congress have solidified osimertinib as the new frontline standard for patients with EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer, Clark A. Lowe, MD, told us when he stopped by. The third generation TKI was found to improve median OS by 6.8 months when compared with the second generation TKIs, erlotinib or gefitinib, in this patient population, despite crossover between arms. Specifically, Lowe told us that the median OS was 38.6 months versus 31.8 months in the osimertinib and comparator arms respectively, which translated to a 20% reduction in the risk of death. In our interview, Lowe, Director of Thoracic Oncology at Intermountain Healthcare, provided insight on the role of osimertinib in EGFR-mutated disease and shared next steps for research in this space.
I believe that the FLAURA trial convincingly has set what is the standard of care for first-line treatment of EGFR-mutated disease, namely that osimertinib should be used as opposed to earlier first- or second-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And I believe that this is due to a combination of factors. This is due to its demonstration of improvement in overall survival, which has not previously been seen in other TKI studies. I think it's also due to its efficacy in treating CNS disease, and additionally due to its tolerability with toxicity that is on par with first generation TKIs, but significantly better tolerated than second generation TKIs. So I think it's the confluence of these factors that lead me to interpret the FLAURA style as really setting the standard of care treatment for first line EGFR mutated disease. What I'm really excited about is what happens with patients who are on osimertinib as first line treatment and then what happens subsequently. And looking at what are the mechanisms of resistance to osimertinib, we're beginning to get some data that suggests there's a lot of different mechanisms of resistance, but one of the ones that's seen quite commonly is MET amplification. And I think that's an opportunity where we can use another TKI specifically for MET amplification that could perhaps allow the patient to continue their TKI, both osimertinib, and add an additional MET amplification TKI and stay on that therapy and get additional benefit before seeing chemotherapy. So that was something that was reported earlier this year in the TATTON trial, where an yet unapproved MET inhibitor, savolitinib, was added to osimertinib and seemed to be very promising, although it's still very early phase data.
Another practice-changing trial was the Phase 3 PACIFIC trial, in which the PD-L1 inhibitor durvalumab improved survival in patients with stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, said Anna Chalmers, MD. Findings from the initial analysis of the trial showed a 32% reduction in the risk of death with durvalumab versus placebo, which led to the FDA approval of the immunotherapy drug for use in this patient population. Three-year follow-up data from a postdoc overall survival analysis continued to show a benefit with the agent. These data changed the standard of care for this patient population and opened the door for potential concurrent chemoradiation and immunotherapy combinations. In our interview, Chalmers, a clinical instructor in the Division of Oncology and an investigator at Huntsman Cancer Institute of the University of Utah, discussed the implications of the PACIFIC trial on the treatment of those with stage 3 disease.
The PACIFIC trial, as I said, randomized patients to durvalumab or not. Patients had to be, after they completed chemoradiation, had to be randomized. Initially, it was within 14 days, but that was changed to 42 days, so they had to start within 42 days of completion of treatment. Patients were randomized based off of age and smoking status as well as sex. It was randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion, and it showed a significant overall survival benefit even at 3 years. This held across all subgroup analysis, although there were some exceptions. So EGFR, there was a very small number, and so it's difficult to really say what this means. But smoking status, age, all these things, that the benefit still held. The one thing that's controversial at this point is PD-L1 status. So they stratified patients based off of PD-L1 25% or more, or less than 25%. In Europe, they requested a post hoc analysis of greater than 1%. And that analysis did not show a benefit for patients who had no PD-L1 expression. Therefore, the approval there is for only patients that are PD-L1 positive. In the United States, we treat patients regardless of PD-L1 status, but it's an open question. It should be noted that really not all patients on trial had tissue to test PD-L1, and therefore were going with incomplete data. I think for a lot of people, one of the other unanswered questions is in terms of patients with actionable mutations, so EGFR, ALK. Well, it's a significant patient population for us here in Utah, since we have a lot more non-smokers. So what do those patients truly benefit? You know, from what we know in the metastatic setting and single agent immunotherapy, for those patients doesn't have a significant effect. Therefore, do we expect a benefit in earlier stage? You know, the biology of earlier stage non-small lung cancer might be slightly different in terms of immunotherapy, but we also don't want to be doing harm with these agents, so it's an open question. There are a lot of novel immunotherapy trials out there for investigation, so there are many of the other PD-1, PD-L1 drugs, including atezolizumab, pembro, nivolumab, and ipilimumab, they're all kind of looking at these as well. So many of them are doing similar studies, that they're doing consolidation after chemo radiation in stage three. A lot of people are trying to get immunotherapy involved earlier, so trying to use immunotherapy either prior to chemo radiation or during chemo radiation. There are definitely trials looking at omitting chemotherapy altogether. These are for patients who have high PD-L1, so they're sort of stratifying them based off of PD-L1. What we know from the Pacific trial is when patients were received immunotherapy received immunotherapy within 14 days of randomization, they had a better hazard ratio for overall survival as opposed to after 14 days. And part of the rationale for using immunotherapy after chemo radiation is this idea of the abscopal effect and sort of the immune modulating effects of radiation with immunotherapy, and we do know some data from the stage four setting that perhaps there is sort of an additive of doing them together. Therefore, it makes sort of biologic sense and rational sense to use it at the same time as radiation.
Sanam Puri, MD, an assistant professor of medical oncology at Huntsman Cancer Institute of the University of Utah, then stopped by to elaborate on the various novel immunotherapy combinations that have emerged in the treatment of patients with metastatic, non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, a field that has seen quite a lot of growth over the past couple of years. Combinations of immunotherapy with HDAC or VEGF inhibitors are of particular interest and are the focus of several ongoing trials in the pipeline, according to Puri. In our interview, Puri discussed key developments in metastatic non-squamous disease, the impact of immunotherapy, and some of the pivotal trials that have impacted treatment decisions.
The two regimens that we are currently using every day in the clinic is the combination of carboplatin, pemetrexate, and pembrolizumab, and the combination of atezo, bevacizumab with chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. And there are many trials in this space that are currently ongoing, but I think both the Keynote 189 regimen and the Empower 150 regimen have like clearly established a gold standard that the others are hopefully going to be meeting soon so that they can come into clinical practice. So when we look at the Keynote studies, the population that they look at is metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. However, they did not include the patients with EGFR ALK mutations. Basically, crossover was allowed in those trials, which basically does, to some extent, help us evaluate what would be the impact of sequence. So, you know, the Keynote 189 trial has clearly established that even if you cross over and receive IO in the second line setting, the fact that you receive a triplet, your best treatment first, you are going to have a survival benefit. The Empower 150 study is also like a beautiful clinical trial design because although they enrolled a similar population of patients, patients with EGFR and ALK mutation was included, although they were not part of the primary outcome analysis, which was PFS and OS in the wild type population. I think even the exploratory analysis from that trial has given us key insights to what works in that population. We all know that chemotherapy works really well in the population of patients with EGFR or ALK mutations that progress on TKI. We know that VEGF actually also worked really well in that population. And if you look at a lot of clinical trials from the third world countries, or the countries that do not have access to osimertinib frontline. We have data now from two big trials showing that addition of VEGF inhibition improves survival in that population. So the EMPOWER study has like beautifully combined IO, chemo, and VEGF inhibition and shown us a direction of benefit in that population, which is now being explored individually in two new trials, which is looking only at EGFR mutant patients who progress on TKIs. So I think both in their own regards have given us new standards and new things to think about. This is an area of great research. I like strongly encourage everybody to enroll a patient in second and third line clinical trials. At HCI, we are looking at combinations with standard of care chemotherapy and novel agents. So we're combining docetaxel with canakinumab, and we are looking at combinations of IO with VEGF inhibition, which is our COSMIC trial. And we're also looking at novel therapeutic strategies like cellular therapy, so like T-cell receptor therapy in lung cancer. I think this is the future of patients who fail chemo and IO. I'm also excited about novel IO combinations. So in that regard, there is a very recent phase 1-2 trial that was published in CCR looking at pembrolizumab and HDAC inhibition. And majority of the patients on that trial were IO pretreated. And even after failing IO, there was a substantial disease control rate seen in the early phase part of the trial. So I think like these novel combinations of IO with HDAC inhibitors, IO with VEGF inhibition is really what I'm looking forward to in the next few years.
In the stage 4 squamous non-small cell lung cancer setting, immunotherapy has emerged as the preferred frontline treatment, according to Shivan B. Patel, MD, MBA, FACP. However, the question of which subsets benefit most from using it in combination with chemotherapy is still unanswered. To improve on the benefits seen with pembrolizumab monotherapy, the agent was then examined in combination with chemotherapy in the KEYNOTE-407 trial. After a median follow-up of 7.8 months, the median OS was 15.9 months with chemoimmunotherapy versus 11.3 months in the placebo arm. These data led to the October 2018 approval of the PD-1 inhibitor in combination with carboplatin and either paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel for the treatment of patients with metastatic squamous disease. Also, the addition of atezolizumab to carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel led to a clinical OS benefit among a subset of patients with advanced squamous disease, according to data from the Phase 3 EMPOWER 131 trial. In our interview, Patel delved deeper into pivotal trials examining chemoimmunotherapy and provided insight into how to apply these data to practice.
When immunotherapy first was approved, we were using it in the second line setting, and as these trials have come out, especially KEYNOTE-24, which looked at it in a specific population, and now KEYNOTE-42, which I'll go over, as monotherapy is sort of transitioned into the first line as monotherapy, and now we're seeing it used in combination with chemotherapy in the first line as well. In general, if they're between 1 to 49%, I think chemo plus immunotherapy is the standard of care. But I've had several patients in their 80s that just don't want chemo. I personally don't think they're fit enough for chemo. So my personal opinion or their preference. And prior to the FDA approval for monotherapy alone, I've even had to get free drug for these patients with immunotherapy alone. But now it is FDA approved. And so I've just treated them in immunotherapy by themselves. They've actually done quite well. So I do think there's a role for that, even though my preference is to give them both chemo and immunotherapy if I thought they could tolerate it or if they were in and they wanted it. And so I think there's some flexibility there, but again, our job is to tailor it to each particular patient. So that's one example. Another example would be a patient that's a very high biomarker, PD-L1 50%, but they're super sick. They have a high burden of disease. I know I need to get a quick response rate, even though it seems like the survival is pretty similar in that population between immunotherapy by itself and chemo and immunotherapy. We know the response rates are higher by doing chemo immunotherapy. So in that case, even though they have a PD-L1 greater than 50%, I would still probably give them chemo immunotherapy to try to shrink down their tumor so they can feel better.
We closed out the evening with Katie Kerrigan, MD, who told us that following the 2016 FDA approval of crizotinib, agents designed to target ROS1 mutated advanced non-small cell lung cancer have been rapidly emerging and showing impressive signals of activity. According to Kerrigan, a hematology-oncology fellow at the University of Utah School of Medicine, the approval of crizotinib revolutionized the treatment of this disease. Another agent, entrectinib, demonstrated a 79.2% objective response rate in this patient subgroup. The ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer space has also experienced growth with agents in the first-line setting, like alectinib and ceritinib, and lorlatinib and brigatinib in the second-line space. In our interview, Kerrigan provided insight into the novel agents that have emerged in the treatment of patients with ROS1 and ALK-mutated disease, and the sequencing challenges that remain.
The approval basically revolutionized the treatment of this disease. Crizotinib quickly became the frontline agent for ROS1 mutated advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and then really opened up a number of both basic science and translational clinical research. And now we have more than 5 agents to treat ROS1 mutated disease. So it really laid the framework for the management of this disease. The second player that came on the block was ceritinib, which really isn't used in clinical practice. But the newest agent, which recently got FDA approval in August of this year, is entrectinib, which was presented in 2019 at a European lung conference, also showing great responses, and it may actually become the new frontline standard. Lorlatinib and the newest kid on the block, repotrectinib, are also being studied in earlier phase trials for patients who have relapsed on one prior ROS1 TKI. So now we have multiple options, which is a great space to be in. Entrectinib will probably trump crizotinib and become the new first-line standard of care based on 2 reasons. One, it had slightly higher objective response rates, so more patients were likely to benefit from the agent. And then it had higher intracranial activity. So for those patients with brain metastases, it's a great option and it's more likely to be beneficial in those patients. So I think for that reason, it probably will be the frontline agent. Once I know that a patient has ROS1 mutated disease, I think I will weigh my decision on whether or not they have brain metastases. If they do up front, I think I would prefer entrectinib based on those higher responses in the brain. If they don't, I think crizotinib still does really remain a good first-line option. I think it will really depend on out-of-pocket cost for patients and insurance approval. After crizotinib, I do think it's important that we re-biopsy these patients and try to determine their mechanism of resistance. If it appears that they still have a ROS1 dependent mechanism driving their cancer, I think both lorlatinib or a clinical trial looking at the use of repotrectinib are both good options. Both drugs have been shown in the second line setting to have good efficacy at about a 30 to 40% objective response rate. So I think both drugs would be a good second line option. For ALK at least, ensartinib is in clinical trials. It's a third generation ALK TKI. We don't really have a ton of data on it yet, but we do have first, second, and third generation ALK TKIs now kind of in our treatment armamentarium, which is great. Particularly in ALK mutated disease, these patients can live a really long time. We don't even have overall survival data for the second and third generation ALK TKIs at this point. So I think it's really important to know how to sequence these agents to give our patients the maximum benefit, obviously for the longest period of time. So here in the US, at least, alectinib, based on the ALEX trials, become the frontline standard of care. I think we don't really know if brigatinib, another second generation ALK TKI, is really that efficacious post-alectinib. There are some retrospective reviews suggesting it's probably not that great, and that lorlatinib is probably superior. But we still don't really know how immunotherapy comes into play. We do have data saying that single agent immunotherapy is probably not that effective. But should we be combining it with chemotherapy alone, or should we be combining it with chemotherapy with VEGF monoclonal antibodies? I think we still need more information, and the sequencing of all of these agents kind of remains under investigation. Hopefully we'll know more at upcoming meetings, just so that we can give our patients obviously the longest and best quality of life for the time they have.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have 2 upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about cutting-edge treatment strategies in genitourinary cancer, register for the November 13th State of the Science Summit in Nashville, Tennessee. We'll also be holding a State of the Science Summit on melanoma on November 14th in New York, New York. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.